Alex, thank you for joining us this morning. Alex, we had a little bit of everything this weekend. Looking out of the studio window here, it's a beautiful Park City fall morning. But boy, yesterday we got a little taste of the winter, didn't we?
Well, I tell you, I sat inside all day shivering. No matter, it couldn't seem to get the house warm enough. So
yeah,
get ready.
We went up to the Montage and hung out in their lobby with the big fireplace and stayed warm and enjoyed reading some books. Speaking of books, our first guest this morning on Mound Money is Daryl West. He is one of the members of the Brookings Institute, and he's written a book called Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. And it really talks about a lot of the political influence that billionaires now have. It's a controversial topic. Daryl is an expert in the subject, and we're looking for the conversation with him.
And then in studio, we're going to talk to Rob Kuntz and Jeremy Lund, and they're going to talk about their accelerator campaign. The Park City Project started about 2 years ago by the Park City Angel Network as a seed for economic development. Currently, there are 12 companies residing out on Rasmussen Road, and they've occupied that site since 2014. So that should be an interesting conversation. And then following that, we're going to talk to Morgan Nicholson, CEO of Manassas Travel, and he's going to talk about the results of recent surveys and the uptick in business travel.
You're listening to Mountain Money, the show about making money, spending it wisely, and investing it well. Book Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. Mr. West is a vice president and director of governance at the Brookings Institute, which is one of the most respected think tanks, one of the oldest think tanks in the United States. And we're honored to have Daryl West as a guest. Daryl, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
So, Daryl, your book really is a kind of an essay discussion on the influence that billionaires are making, really unprecedented in U.S. history, in politics. As I mentioned in the open, it's a controversial topic. We're going to talk about both sides of it. But I want you to start off, if you would, with sharing with us what is the main issue that prompted you to write the book and to do this research?
I wrote the book to ask who these individuals are, how they got so rich, and then what they're doing with their immense wealth. There are about 500 billionaires in the United States, and I've had encounters with maybe 20 of them. And so I also wanted to know, you know, what they are like as people. So I try to include personal stories about my encounters with them in the book as well.
Okay. And what are the main thrusts of the book is really the political influence? And I know the Brookings Institute, that's its primary driver, is really political thought, political discussion, giving some quality thought into the ramifications of current political trends. And so with that in mind, what did you find out about the influence of billionaires on U.S. politics?
Well, we're used to thinking about the top 1% and their role in politics. Billionaires represent the 0.00001%. So we're talking about a very small cross-section, but these people are becoming very politically active. So, for example, the Koch brothers this year it's been reported that they will spend about $290 million trying to influence the campaign. Michael Bloomberg is getting very active. He's pledged $50 million to fight the issue of gun violence. He also is going to spend another $25 million trying to support centrist candidates, especially in some of the Senate races. There's a California billionaire named Tom Steyer who's concerned about climate change. He's pledged $50 million of his own money there. So in a lot of these states, we are seeing dueling billionaires contest these crucial Senate races.
Well, you also talk about the differences between the results of some billionaires and their campaigns and the results of others on both sides of the political spectrum. On one hand, you had Meg Whitman, who lost her campaign after spending a lot of money. And on the other hand, you have Bloomberg, who spent a ton of his money. How does that balance itself out? And why doesn't the public necessarily understand the impact of, not so much the impact, but understand the depth of what's happening with these political contributions?
Well, a lot of people believe that if billionaires are spending a lot of money, that means that automatically, they are going to win. But we've seen many examples where they spent a lot, but were not politically successful. So, for example, in 2012, there were a number of conservative billionaires who spent a lot trying to defeat Obama, but yet they obviously lost. We've seen Bloomberg has put a lot of effort into immigration reform, but has not been successful there. But then we are seeing billionaires be very influential, especially at the state level. So there are people who have funded same-sex marriage. They put money into support for the legalization of marijuana. And so I try and kind of outline what are the conditions under which the money matters and allows billionaires to be very successful versus other circumstances where they are wasting their money and not being very effective.
Well, let's talk about a couple of those. What did your findings come up with?
Well, at the state level, that often is where billionaires have been the most influential, because in states, like, you know, if you talk about a mid-sized state like Utah, you know, if a billionaire comes in and drops, you know, $3 million or $5 million into a campaign, that's a major expenditure. And so oftentimes at the state level is where we see the greatest influence. They're especially becoming very active in state referenda there have been a number of cases where they've spent a lot and their side has won. And so those are the types of situations that people should be paying attention to.
As Alex and I were talking before the show, you know, one of the pivotal moments in U.S. history that I think opened the door for this type of influence is the relatively recent Supreme Court ruling that corporations can now give unlimited amounts to political campaigns. Do you agree that that was really the beginning of the large spending that we're seeing now? And what's been the impact of that?
Those Supreme Court decisions have been absolutely crucial because they have allowed much bigger amounts of money to come into the political process, and they also have allowed much less disclosure. So there's more secrecy in the political process. I'm not just concerned about the amount of money, but I think the secrecy is a big problem. The rise of so-called dark money, money that where the donor is not disclosed, is growing. There was just a New York Times analysis of the current Senate races that found that 55% of the broadcast ads were basically funded by organizations that were not disclosing their donors. And so this creates, I think, a real problem in our election process, because for voters, the messenger is as important as the message.
So what we're really, what I'm hearing is there's a lack of transparency, I think, in the new campaign finance reform laws. Why are we losing transparency?
We're losing it because the court has basically allowed great loopholes to open in our system of campaign finance. We all remember after the Watergate scandal, there was an emphasis on disclosure. There were limitations on how much could be spent. But over the last 40 years or so, there have been a number of loopholes that have been created in the system. And now it's possible for a billionaire to come in and spend $10 million or $25 or $50 or $100 million, and oftentimes they don't have to disclose that spending. And so I think this creates a lot of problems in our political process. You know, all of this is taking place at a time where there are a growing number of billionaires, and they're becoming very active on a wide variety of topics. And we have liberal billionaires, we have conservative ones, there are libertarian ones. And when you look at the current Senate races, a lot of them are being very active because essentially control of the Senate is coming down to six or seven different states. They're putting a lot of money into contesting those races.
So where has the media gone in all of this? What is their role, and how has that changed in transparency?
Well, billionaires are understanding that the media are important, so they're starting to buy media outlets. You know, we have Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox News and The Wall Street Journal. Michael Bloomberg has purchased Business Week. Jeff Bezos just bought The Washington Post. So that's one response. But then at the same time, because of the financial crisis of 2009 and thereafter, a lot of news organizations have had to lay off reporters, and so there's a lot less scrutiny today. And I think this is especially true at the state level. There have been studies kind of looking at the number of journalists that are covering state politics full-time. There's been a dramatic decline in those numbers over the last 10 years. And so the irony is, as billionaires are spending more and more money at the state level, there's less scrutiny of what they are doing because there just simply aren't as many reporters covering their activities as used to be the case.
You know, something you mentioned earlier, Daryl, was, you know, you've got some billionaires that are relatively liberal. You've got some that are fairly conservative. Is the net result that it balances out in the end?
Well, if we had a perfect balance of liberal money, liberal billionaire money offsetting conservative money, I would not be so worried about this situation. But what we are seeing now is much more of the big money is coming in on the conservative side. For example, if you look at the 2012 contributions to super PACs, about 80% of that really big money came in on the conservative side. And also, when you look at kind of the tax issue, you know, this has been an issue where, although liberal and conservative billionaires don't agree on very many things, the one topic on which they do agree is not wanting there to be higher taxes on wealthy individuals. And so, you know, they often have fought very hard to keep that from happening.
You know, one of the billionaires that's been in the press recently talking about that topic and asking for a broader discussion on it in a very controversial way. Is a gentleman named Tom Perkins, who is the co-founder of Kleiner Perkins, a highly successful venture capital firm. They were initial money in some of the biggest. Well, first off, they were one of the first venture capital firms in the U.S. and one of the most successful. And I was surprised to see when I did a little bit of background research on your book, the Wall Street Journal did a review of your book, and the author of the review was Tom Perkins. Did that surprise you that Tom Perkins was the person they chose to do the review of your book?
It did surprise me, because you would think for a book that is critical about the growing political activism of billionaires, they would not have chosen a billionaire to review the book. But, you know, they had their reasons. Someone actually wrote in the Wall Street Journal online comment section that this was like having the wolf review Little Red Riding Hood.
He did have some interesting perspectives. And, you know, I do want to bring up one of the topics that makes Mr. Perkins fairly controversial right now, which is, you know, he didn't do it in a well-worded way, but basically he said, you know, really the tide is turning now, and we as billionaires kind of feel we're being picked on, for lack of a better term. He compared his struggle with how Jews were treated in Nazi Germany, and that's what created all the controversy. But what about the main thrust of his point? Are we, in a bizarre way, are we discriminating against billionaires, and has the pendulum swung too far?
It's interesting. I mentioned earlier that I've had a number of personal encounters with billionaires, and oftentimes I have heard that type of sentiment, that a lot of billionaires actually feel misunderstood. They feel like, you know, they've worked hard, they've come up with an idea that's been very successful in their businesses, they've made a lot of money in the process, and they don't understand all the criticism. In fact, they feel misunderstood by big parts of society. So in my book, like, I have no problems with people making money. You know, that's as American as apple pie. If they want to, you know, build their businesses, they're creating jobs, that's all great. What I'm concerned about is when they try and convert their economic power into political power. That kind of brings them into the public dialogue, and that's the part that has created a lot of criticism about billionaires. And so I try and analyze, you know, what they're doing, you know, what the balance is between liberal and conservative billionaires. I try and put a lot of facts on the table just in terms of how they're trying to contest elections these days, and then people can form their own opinions about it after that.
Yeah, you know, I personally think billionaires should have a voice. I want them to have a seat at the table, but I don't want them to own the table. And so how do we create that environment where they do have a voice? I mean, they've been very successful in business. We need successful people providing insights into some of the nation's biggest problems. But how do we keep them from owning the table?
Well, I'm very interested in that topic because I grew up in a rural area. I actually grew up on a dairy farm in Ohio. And so, you know, my family didn't have a lot of money, but, you know, I got a great education and I ended up having great opportunities in my life. And so in my book, I try and talk about the need for greater transparency in the political process just so we know where the money is coming from. But I also talk about the importance of maintaining opportunity. I mean, we know that the middle class is squeezed these days. You know, it's hard for people to afford the cost of colleges. There are problems in the healthcare system. And so, I wrote the book because I wanted to make sure that the young kids today who are growing up without advantages still have an opportunity to do well. I think that's one of the most important things we can do to make sure that billionaires don't just run the world.
Well, that actually leads into a different part of your book. Actually, not so much different, but the perception by some billionaires that they worked hard and the fruits of their own labor got them to where they are, and that the rest of us should fend for ourselves. And that's perhaps an oversimplification. But I think you mentioned in the book the differing views on social programs between the truly wealthy and, I think you call us, the general public. What's behind that? There's a huge differential between how much we should spend on education. And in your own example, you're saying that education was critical to your success, as I think it was to mine and to Doug's. Why do you think the billionaires have a totally different viewpoint on that and why they want to spend less rather than more?
I mean, one of the things I did in the book was kind of compare the views of the top 1% versus the general public. There have been public opinion surveys on kind of the same issues in terms of education, healthcare, the role of government, and so on. And the surprising thing was finding that people with a lot of money consistently took a more conservative stance on a lot of issues. The irony is more than two-thirds of billionaires actually are self-made. You know, they're people who either started out poor or maybe they had a middle-class upbringing. But, you know, they were able to, you know, get an education and end up doing well in the process. But yet, now that they have money, not all of them are interested in funding the social programs that would allow the current generation of young people to do well. And so I thought it was interesting there was such a strong contrast between their lack of willingness to fund education compared to the views of the general public.
Well, underlying that, it seems, leads into your one of the phrases or chapters in the book says, it takes a village to make a billionaire. Maybe you could expand on that a little more.
Well, I was very interested in how people made their money, and certainly billionaires had a good idea. They were able to build their businesses and become very wealthy in the process. But when you look at how people keep wealth, certainly the tax laws have been very important because a lot of people with a lot of financial resources have advantaged tax laws. They were able to either, instead of paying the ordinary salary rate, they may pay half the rate through the capital gains tax or through other types of provisions. And so when you look at the history of tax law over the last century, you can see how certain types of laws make it easier for people to keep their money and to maintain their wealth.
Yeah, and I love the fact that two-thirds of these billionaires really made their own fortunes. It didn't come from being born into the right family. It really came from hard work, a good idea, and executing it and working really, really hard. And I think that's the American dream. And the Brookings Institute has done a lot of work on the subject of influence in politics. Officially, the Brookings Institute is neutral politically. And it's one of the oldest think tanks in the country, started in 1916 by Robert Brookings. And one of the questions I have for you is, I look at how Robert Brookings chose to influence politics, right? He started this institute. FDR used the institute during the Great Depression to help him think through some different ways. How could he get the country out of the Great Depression? Partly to the work of the Brookings Institute, the United Nations was started, the Congressional Budget Office was started, welfare reform was done. All items that I think most people would look back and say, these are good things for the country. So why do you think more people aren't choosing to influence, maybe in this more subtle way, but more in a perpetual way? Why does it have to be immediate? Why does it have to be now versus taking almost the Brookings Institute is almost 100 years old now. And Robert Brookings' initial thrust in work is still influencing politics today. Why is it so short-term focused today?
A lot of billionaires made their money in business, and so now in their philanthropy, they are bringing kind of a business person's perspective. So they want impact. They often are developing performance metrics. And so I think there's more of a short-term focus on gift-giving today. I have a chapter on philanthropy and how billionaires are kind of using their money for broader social purposes. And when you look at them, many of them are very focused on having impact. They often have a short-term focus, and they hold their grantees accountable through these performance metrics. And so, in the good old days, rich people would kind of give universities and hospitals money and say, okay, I'm interested in this problem. You figure out what the solution is. Today, it's more common for rich people to basically not just be concerned about a problem, but to have a particular solution that they think will make a difference. And so I suggest universities have to be much more careful in dealing with philanthropy just because of the new ways, the new models of philanthropy that we're starting to see.
Well, on a somewhat lighter note, you mentioned a couple times in the book about the thin-skinned billionaires, and you had at least two examples or two encounters with them, and maybe you can share that with us.
Well, my favorite example was Donald Trump. Speaking of thin-skinned, he certainly qualifies. I'd been interviewed 2 years ago in the summer right before the Republican convention because there was talk about Trump speaking at the convention. And so I made a comment that they should send him on an all-expenses trip around the world because if he actually spoke at the convention, he would bring Republicans nothing but trouble. So the quote was published. I didn't think too much about it, but the morning that the quote appeared in the newspaper, I got a call from Trump's personal assistant, and she asked for my email address, which I gave her, and then shortly thereafter, she sent me a missive from the billionaire himself in which he said, "Daryl, you are a fool. Best wishes, Donald J. Trump." So at that point, I was surprised that he cared what I had said about him, but apparently he did.
That's funny. Well, our guest this morning has been Daryl West. He is the Vice President and Director of Governance at the Brookings Institute. He's also the author of Billionaires, losing the subtitle here, Billionaires, Reflections of the Upper Crust. Daryl, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and then missed out there for a moment, but next up is going to be Rob Kuntz and Jeremy Lund to talk about their accelerator campaign started by the Park City Angel Network.
That's right. And an accelerator basically helps entrepreneurs, gives them some tools to succeed. You're listening to KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back. We have Rob Kuntz and Jeremy Lund to talk about their accelerator campaign. Started in 2014, and how that's enabled currently a dozen businesses to get started up with some seed money and hopefully bring some new businesses and new opportunities here to Park City. So welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning.
So, what made you guys get involved in wanting to start up this accelerator network? I think it's also been called variously by different people, an incubator.
Yes. Yeah, we're still trying to figure out who we're going to be when we grow up, so we don't know what to call ourselves yet, to be honest. We started it more from we went to a meeting that Miles Rademan put together up at Andy's place at the Treasure Mountain Inn. And, really talking about diversifying the economic base past just snow sports here in Park City and in Summit County. And, Dan McFaun and Marco Messina and a couple other Park City Angels and I got together and said, what's one piece of that we can take on? You know, what's a discrete thing we can get off the ground as opposed to, I guess Miles has been talking about this for 20 plus years now and hasn't found a lot of purchase in getting something started. So we said, let's just get something started and decided to do an incubator, accelerator, whatever you want to call it, program. The more we looked at it, the more we realized that there was a lot of interest in this space in Utah in general and actually nationwide. And didn't know what we individually had to offer in that. And that's how we came up to partner with Rob and want to partner with other more established accelerator incubator programs. Let them run it in Park City because we think we have the geography here. We have some really great mentors. But, in terms of actually running the backbones of the program, partner with established people that are going to be able to really help us leverage, our space and our mentor base and do something different.
And Rob, let's have you talk a little bit and actually start at the beginning, if you can, and share with our audience what an accelerator is. You and I talked recently, and one of the observations I made is there are some really young people that are starting some really exciting and very valuable companies. People might be interested in knowing, like companies like Dropbox that many of us are familiar with. That was started by Drew Houston in his early 20s. And there's just example after example of young founders building companies that become billion-dollar-plus companies. So what is an accelerator, and how does it help in that process?
Yeah, Doug, so the accelerator model, basically, we call ourselves a mentorship-driven seed accelerator. And so what that means is we provide usually about 10 to 12 companies a year. We provide them the initial seed capital. That's why we're a seed accelerator. And that's $20,000 to $30,000 in a small cash kind of contribution. And we also provide them about $250,000 in value in kind services. And these are all the services a company needs to really get started and rolling. So it's things like accounting help. It's things like hosting from Rackspace. It's things like Microsoft software. It's everything a company can possibly need in the first year to really get going. And then we surround the companies with anywhere between 35 to 50 mentors that are really hands-on. And these are serial entrepreneurs, these are investors that have invested in them. And essentially what they're doing is getting hands-on and just helping those companies all the way through this very intense three-month program that we have. And so one of the things that we've recognized recently is the cost of the software and the technology of, with cloud computing and open source has really dramatically gone down. And so what that allows these younger individuals to do is start these companies with like $50,000 to $100,000, where historically before it'd be $2 to $4 million to start that same company. So with a combination of the cloud computing and the technology costs going down, wrapping around mentorship and initial seed capital, those are really kind of the successful ingredients for those companies to get launched.
So you've been doing this for about 5 years now, running programs first in Salt Lake City. You expanded down to Utah
Provo.
County
yep.
a year or two ago.
Yep.
Now you're coming up here to Summit County. with Pando Labs, partnering with them, and you're about to launch a program in a couple weeks. What and so if people are interested and they're listening, there's still time for them to apply and see if they can get into this program. What type of companies, what type of ideas, what type of founders are you looking for? Who should apply?
Yeah, so we look primarily for software technology companies, although recently we've taken in basically one or two consumer product companies because there's a convergence of hardware and software basically coming together. And so therefore, we love, you know, outdoor product companies. Any companies where there's a, you know, hardware and software component should also apply. And then, of course, our more classic model is people just being, you know, mobile application platforms or software as a service, cloud computing based applications for business to business and also business to consumer. And we're going to keep our apps open for about another 2 to 3 weeks. So everyone should get their application in. They can go to the boomstartup.com website to go on and apply, basically.
And if they get in, they get, what's the investment?
Yeah, so we provide $20,000 cash infusion from day one. And in return, we get 6% common equity for that investment. And then they get this $250,000 value in kind services, which is really a huge help to the company so they don't have to take the investment and go purchase all these services.
And also 90 days of really intensive mentorship. It's really a full-time program when they're going through this. And they have access to some mentors that otherwise would be really hard to get in touch with. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's very intense for the whole 3 month period, basically. So, yeah, it's been good.
You know, Jeremy mentioned Miles' interest in this for 20 plus years. And a year and a half or so ago, we were on city tour and we stopped in Ogden. And they also have an incubator program. How does that differ from yours? I'm peripherally familiar with what they're doing up there. And it seemed like I think they're in partnership with Utah State. And how does that work? And how do you see that as in relationship to your model?
Yeah, we are working with Alex Lawrence, who's running the incubator up there. And he was one of the sites that really steered us away from we want to run our own program, to be honest, is, you know, looking at what he had and how he was going to run things. Let us say, hey, look, we can still do something that's going to make a difference to Summit County, but not have to own the entire backbone. You know, he has the resources of Weber State to be able to pull in to run his actual incubator program up there. A piece of that is co-working space, which is really what we're focusing on as well. I think we're somewhat modeled like his, only as opposed to Weber State running the actual programming, we're trusting people like Boom Startup and impact investment leaders and some others who are going to be running programs in the space, but then you can still come there, co-work, hang out with like-minded people, you know, run your ideas past other people that are starting companies. And I think that's one of the really powerful things they're doing up in Ogden is, you know, having the co-working space.
You know, one of the things I think is a natural advantage to Park City is we tend to be a place people want to move to oftentimes after they've had their first or second success, right? They've built up their net worth. They don't have to work so hard anymore. They want to slow down. They want to live in a town that's a fun town to live in. They're active. They've been coming out here on vacation. So I think one of the niches for us here in Park City and Summit County is really the second and third time entrepreneurs, folks that have had a success. You know, it's starting these companies is so intensive. It destroys a lot of families. It destroys a lot of lives along the way. We all hear these great stories, but you know, on TechCrunch or you see somebody interviewed some 30-year-old that just sold his company for $1 billion or $19 billion to Facebook, and you all think, "Wow, I want to be that person." Well, of course you do, but the path is really, really difficult. And I think one of the advantages Park City has is we attract folks that have already gone through this. They're successful, and now they want to work on their second or third venture, but not quite as hard. Do you guys agree with that there is a potential niche there? And is that something that maybe Pando Labs down the road could help facilitate, or Boom Startup could help facilitate? And is that even a niche we should be looking at?
No, I absolutely think that's one of the niches we should be looking at. I mean, you know, one of the common refrains as we were chopping this idea around and doing our due diligence on how do we do it here is, well, Park City's so expensive. There's no way you're going to get a startup accelerator started in Park City. And to me, you know, you look at New York, you look at the Valley, you look at San Francisco, and our cost of living is less than any of those places, right?
That's a good retort.
Yeah, you know, so to me, it's more, even as opposed to it's your second, third time entrepreneurs, I don't see why you can't. Why we can't have a 30-year-old that builds a business here and sells it for $19 billion. I think the flip side is if you really look at it, and I, you know, Rob probably has more raw data on this than I do. I just have kind of my horse sense and, you know, a few years experience. But the second and third time entrepreneurs are more likely to be successful in their next venture than the first time entrepreneur. And if we could attract those people here and really develop a thriving entrepreneurial community amongst those where they already kind of know what they want, but also know what they need to round out their skill set. You know, I need help on marketing because I'm weak on that. And that's, you know, the great thing about Park City as a community is there are so many retired executives here that were marketing people, that were accountants, that were, you know, name your skill set here. If we can link all those into that community, we really have something powerful.
Yeah, and one of the things I like about what you're doing is you're kind of whetting the appetite for some of these executives, right? They start off mentoring, they have fun doing that, and they're like, you know, maybe I do want to get back in the game again. Maybe I can only ski 2 or 3 days a week. I really don't want to ski 7 days a week.
Well, I'm just wondering, is there an opportunity for a 65-year-old to make, say, $9 billion for his company? Because that would be certainly
that's
of interest.
Acceptable to you.
That would be totally.
You better be careful because Darrell West is going to write you up in his next book if you do that.
It's okay. If I could be in his next book because of that, I'd be thrilled. So anyway, what's the Angels' ongoing role in this? You're called the Park City Project. I guess that's a subset or.
It's a name I'm trying to get from the state right now, yes. There were a bunch of Park City project management companies, so the state wouldn't green light the name, and Pando Labs was going to be the sub-brand underneath that. So that was the one that I was able to get a 501c3 for, and we'll work on going upstream from there. The Park City Angels' ongoing role is really to provide mentor capital, as well as, you know, we're relying on them heavily for this first boom startup Park City cohort. And, you know, they will provide both capital for the companies as well as providing those lead mentor roles that Rob was talking about. And I think, you know, the interesting thing, again, for the retired executives from Rob's company's perspective is there, I don't know, has it ever happened where one of the lead mentors has gone on and actually joined the company afterwards?
Oh, yeah, that happens, yes.
So, I mean, that I think would be another interesting role going forward is with these seed companies, you have kids with, you know, I've seen a couple in the screening meetings where, hey, it's a great idea, and the kid fundamentally understands, like, here's the technical piece of it. But as you start pushing them on the business side, you realize that they just have absolutely no idea how to block and tackle their way to where they need to get with it. And I think that could be a very interesting role for Park City Angels as well going forward. And we've had, you know, I'm thinking Butara right now, but we just had a successful exit where one of the Park City Angels members stepped in and became CEO of the company and was able to lead it to a successful exit. You know, so I think there's a full circle here that we can really help develop, and I think it requires more diligence on the backside and really pushing the networks as opposed to, you know, oh, I skied for 3 days and I forgot to go down to Pando and mentor. You need somebody to follow up and keep you honest.
You know, and I'm a member of the Park City Angels as well, so I say this with some bias, but I think the Park City Angels and the other angel groups in Utah have really moved the needle for economic development. I know one of our members did a study on how many dollars were invested, and we have to have them come in and talk about it. But it's pretty impressive the amount of dollars, the amount of companies that have been supported, how many jobs have been created. And I know one of the partnerships you guys are currently working on now is having Summit County participate financially as well and to support this as an economic development initiative. Where is that now, and what kind of support, if any, do you need from the community to try to make that happen?
So we're actually, I have gone before county council and asked for funding. Jeff Jones is the new economic development director over there, and I think he's doing a great job. Anita was great as well, but I think that, you know, he's really trying to move the needle. And so, you know, definitely talk to your county council people about it. That would be great. We're going to be in the city budget as well. And I think one of the really refreshing things about starting something new is we are the neutral convening place. Never before of city and county, the economic development directors met on a regular basis. And they're meeting monthly out of Panda Labs right now and trying to sync up and understand how they work together to get new businesses here. So, I mean, again, we came at this from an economic development perspective. And even though we're focusing, you know, we focused the first part of the interview on the incubation piece, this is much more than that. You know, I think we do want to do straight economic development with city and county. We want to help mom and pop businesses that aren't going to fit into Rob's program. You know, ideally, we'd have a nonprofit incubator down the road as well. Is just a matter of growing into that. So, you know, I think it is really, it's nice to get the support of city and county. They're both on board with trying to help us out. It's just a matter of getting into budget cycle. And at the end of the day, you know, there's only so much money and something's got to give. And hopefully it's not us, but.
What I like about this, too, is it's a relatively small commitment.
Yeah.
We're not starting it from scratch. You're not saying, hey, here's what we have an idea. Here's what we want to do. You've partnered with Boom Startup. You guys have done this for 5 years. Dozens of companies have come through. They've got, Rob, you and I have talked in the past about two-thirds, three-fourths of your companies end up getting the next follow-on financing, which is really the benchmark that you look for with an accelerator. I want to briefly go back to the equity investment because, you know, for a lot of people, this is the first time they're going through this. So the thought of giving up 6% of their company, they might be thinking, well, I got this great idea. Why do I want to give it up? You know, the reality is at the end of the 90 days, if your company's 7% more valuable than it was when you went in, you're ahead of the game by giving up a little bit of equity. And I think having seen dozens, if not in my case, hundreds of companies try to grow, try to succeed. It's really, really hard, and having access to investors and mentors is so important. We wish you guys all the best of luck with what you're doing. Rob, if people want to find out more about Boom Startup and apply, how can they do that?
Yeah, the easiest way is just to go to our website at boomstartup.com, and you'll see links right on our home website to our online application process. And so, again, we'll be taking applications until about October 21st, and then we'll be shortlisting those applicants and making a final selection by the first week in November.
Okay, great. And, Jeremy, if people want to find out about Panda Labs, because Panda Labs is much bigger than just the accelerator. It's some shared workspace.
Yep.
If you can't do 90 days in a mentorship-type program, but you want to surround yourself with other entrepreneurs, have access to mentors, that's another route is to reach out to Panda Labs. If they want information on Panda Labs, how can they find out more?
And that is Panda Labs, PANDOLabs.org is our website. And we do have month-to-month office, shared office space. And, you know, definitely would love to get people involved. And, you know, feel free to stop by or just email me at info@pandolabs.org. We'll get to me, and then we can introduce you to the space and tell you more about it.
Rob and Jeremy, thank you for joining us this morning. I'm excited about what you guys are doing. I think it's got a lot of great potential, and I wish you guys all the success. Thank you guys for doing this. It takes a lot of work to make something like this happen.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll be back in a moment on Mound Money on KPCW. Our next guest is going to be Morgan Nicholson. He's the CEO of Manassas Travel. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Sean Railton. I'm an agent with Park City Realty Group. I'm a 30-year Park City resident and a KPCW underwriter. I have been involved in the Park City real estate market since 1994 as an agent, an appraiser, and an investor. I can be reached at 649-1991 or sean@parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Money, we have with us on the phone Morgan Nicholson of Manassas Travel. He's going to give us talk about the results of some surveys and the uptick in business travel. So welcome.
Thank you.
So Morgan, tell us about what you found in terms of business travel and the increase in it and even the types of business travel that your surveys have shown over the last year or so.
Well, we've got some numbers. Basically, Travel Leaders is a huge consortia of U.S.-based travel agencies. And quarterly, we like to do some travel trend surveys throughout the different agencies across the U.S. And this this particular survey really took into account business travel for the first two quarters of 2014. It helps us to kind of gauge where businesses are at. If we feel like there's an economic growth happening, or if we see businesses kind of, you know, skinnying back on their travel. One of the biggest things that we've seen is there is definitely a growth in business travel. Basically, based on last year, we've seen about a 10% growth in business travel. And not only that, there's a 10% growth in what we consider front of the airplane travel, which is business or first class. One of the main things that we've seen is how companies are choosing what flights they're selecting. You know, in the past, when the economy first kind of took a nosedive, we were seeing most companies either not traveling at all or more minimal travel to always taking the lowest fare, regardless of the flight options. That's just not the case anymore. That is actually the last thing that these companies are looking at when they choose flights nowadays. 44% of our corporate clients choose their flights based on their departure and arrival times, as long as it's meeting their corporate travel policy, which basically shows a confidence in business travel growth. So that's been nice. And even just nonstop flights in general, they're not really looking at price so much anymore. You know, that the percentage of them looking at price when they're choosing a flight option is only 8% of their travelers.
That's amazing.
So we see that that's pretty low.
Yeah, that is amazing, and that's a big change that's happened over the last couple of years. Now, did I hear you correct? The survey is done with travel agents, and as I think about that space, it's certainly a larger percentage of folks in the business world use travel agents, but so many people now are booking their flights direct online. So is the source of this information primarily from people, travel agents, or is it also the online tools as well?
This is based on travel agency owners within the Travel Leaders Consortia, also frontline travel agents, owners, managers. So it's from over 1,000 travel agent experts from the Travel Leaders brand.
And so these are already people that are self-selecting, the folks that are working with human travel agents as opposed to an online agency. These are folks that have probably decided, you know what, the service of a travel agent, of being able to talk to somebody, help me if I have any difficulties, is worth, I would imagine it's a slight premium in ticket pricing to do that. So these are people that are probably predisposed to pay for additional service as well. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's absolutely fair to say. We try to tell people, you know, you can absolutely do it online, but the value for your dollar is less. When you're using a travel agency, we tend to take a very strategic approach when we review, analyze, and manage your travel programs, so we can adhere to your travel policies. And we can also provide your, you know, the best return on your investment with your travel spending.
And how is that industry now? I know for a while, boy, market share was just evaporating away from the human travel agents. Are you starting to see the trend go the other way? People have used some of the online services. They haven't had a good experience. And they're like, you know, I really want to have somebody do this for me professionally.
Absolutely. You know, when the industry changed, we did see quite a migration from the travel agency to the online bookings. And, you know, there are still some, we like to call them renegade companies that like to do it on their own. However, their statistics and their numbers when it comes to looking at their travel spendings on a yearly basis, they're always skewed. So we're starting to see those companies that have tried to do it on their own come back around. We feel like we give them more value for their dollar, and it also, there are now so many options to look at when you're booking online that the amount of time that it takes you to book on your own versus you just telling a travel agent, okay, here are my dates, find me these types of flights, it's much more cost effective.
Well, that would certainly seem to be the case. I just wonder, you get into some of these really big companies, the value add of a travel agent, independent travel agent, to their corporate side. Is that what you're finding? Is that particular growth? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, it's definitely growing. We're seeing we have an 11% growth in corporate travel over the past two quarters of 2014, the first two quarters of the year.
Well, this is certainly good news. Park City is a town that a lot of businesses come to. We have our fair share of business meetings, corporate events held here, so we're certainly glad to see people are traveling more, people are willing to spend a little bit more. It's good news, certainly with the changes we've had in Park City here in the last really two and a half years with Vail taking over, not just the Canyons, but now PCMR. They're a big marketing. They've got a great marketing arm. We certainly expect to see more business travel. Morgan, this is good news. Thank you for sharing it with us this morning.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
And
we're gonna go to break now, and we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money. You're listening to KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
This is KPCW Park City. In the automated world of corporate radio, we're locals serving locals with news and information for you. You can support local radio with your donation at kpcw.org.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Interesting conversation, three very interesting guests. Before Alex and I do a little chit-chat wrapping up the show, I do want to thank our great sponsors for the Mountain Money. We couldn't do this without you. There's actually a lot more staff involved in putting on shows like this, not just ours, but the other shows during the week. And we thank our great sponsors, Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco's Designs, and Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. Thank you, gentlemen. We certainly appreciate all the support you've given us, not just recently, but many of you guys for many, many years. Thank you.
Indeed, that's the case. And so talking about our guests, Doug, I think certainly Darryl was fascinating in his characterization of billionaires and their roles. And I wish we would have been able to get into the philanthropic changes that have happened there. That was kind of an interesting line that is in the book. And well, we just didn't quite get to.
I think a really nice trend, too, that we're seeing with very wealthy families, and Warren Buffett gets a lot of the credit for this, is really to start donating their money while they're alive. You know, a lot of great causes, a lot of great institutions are where they are and can move the needle for us as a nation because of the support by billionaires. And like anything, the good comes with some bad, and right now the pendulum is swinging on the political influence. But it's in the public discussion. I think we're going to get to a point where it gets more balanced, don't you think?
Absolutely. And just before we head out, I also want to say Jeremy and Rob, with their incubator startup help, was also a fascinating discussion. And I think people should keep their eye on that, because that is going to be an economic driver for Summit County and Park City going forward.
Yeah, it's certainly proven to be the case in many areas. Of course, the icon is the Bay Area where they're doing this. And hopefully we can replicate a little bit of this right here in town. We haven't shared with you the weather yet. What you see out the window is pretty much what you're going to see all week. Really for the foreseeable future, the next 7 days, sunny, lows in the high 30s, the low 40s, and highs in the upper 60s. You're listening to KPCW on Mountain Money. Thank you for joining us. NPR News is next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.